Welcome to Inside the Black Box. And because someone apparently spelled Hawaiian Punch on the board this morning, we're having trouble with our disclaimer liner. So let me remind our listeners that the opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not necessarily reflect those of WREK Atlanta or the Georgia Institute of Technology. That being said, today's show is the Great American Love Affair with Electric Vehicles. And to talk about this today, we've got Chris Campbell, former chief engineer here at WREK. Electric vehicle enthusiast. He did his bachelor's degree in aerospace engineering at 1990, a double E a few years later here at Georgia Tech. He's a professional engineer licensed in the state of Georgia and has done everything from nuclear power generation as a mechanical engineer to satellite communications, worked for Turner Broadcasting.
Did some telephony in there too.
Okay.
So lots of communications.
Do young people even know what telephony is?
Telephony. Not if you spell, if you pronounce it telephony. If you say telephone E, then they know what it is.
Right. So I actually worked for a molecular modeling software company, and the only programmer we had there who did telephony programmed one of those 900 numbers. And he said it paid quite well.
That's where the money is.
That's
just
actually
like the internet and porn.
That's exactly where it was, right. So this is kind of interesting. You are actually an electric vehicle enthusiast who's going to talk to us about, will there ever be, I guess, a great American love affair with electric vehicles? That's what we eventually want to get to. Do you think it is? Or are you going to make it?
I think it's inevitable.
Okay, all right. That's good to hear because I'm a big fan of electric vehicles, and people just give me a hard time over that. But
there's lots of myths to bust, so we'll get to that.
Okay, and we don't have a bell here to ring for every myth that's busted.
Every time we have a myth busted, I'll try to come up with some sort of sound
effect. We'll go over some of those myths in just a moment. So, Trent, we don't have the science in the news liner, do we?
Right, yeah.
Oh, then what? Hit it.
Science
did you already
in
say?
The news. Okay.
All right. Trent's working his magic. Right. I don't know what's happening there. A lot of
I'm playing with the computer.
Dials are moving. He's typing things. I don't know if it's...
You just do your talking.
Okay, we'll just do the talking. So today's Science in the News is actually really science outreach in the news, and it is the USA Science and Engineering Festival. It's only in its second year, and I just returned from the USA Science and Engineering Festival in Washington, and rarely do I say things are really good. Right. I just whine and complain about everything. But I got to say, Larry Bach, who is they describe him as a serial entrepreneur, a guy who's financed the early stage of 40 companies or more. I'm assuming this guy's loaded, right? Because he was working for free organizing this stuff. But he was very, non-condescending, showed up to the science comedy show we did at Georgetown University wearing the volunteers T-shirt. He was so nice. His daughter did the timer to let the comedians know when they hit 20 minutes when we can move on. I mean, just very helpful. And he does all this, and it is literally a multi-million dollar proposition. They filled up the entirety of the Washington Convention Center in Washington, D.C. And he did it, of course, by getting sponsors. Georgia Tech was there. We had a big booth with lasers and microscopy exhibits, and people paid to get these booths. Lockheed Martin, NASA had giant amounts of floor space. And in the end, it was free. That's the amazing thing. So we literally had thousands and thousands of visitors coming in there and seeing old NASA Apollo capsules. They had one of the Thunderbirds jets right there on the floor. They had Bill Nye, the science guy.
Bill Nye is CEO now of the Planetary Society.
And he was there with the full Planetary Society.
And the Planetary Society, they have a radio show that's weekly that's aired on WRK on Sunday mornings.
Oh, great.
And they were there and they produced their show there, so that'll be on the air here in a week or two.
So something to listen to, absolutely. And the Planetary Society does actually a lot of different stuff. He was here talking about it just a couple months ago right here at Georgia Tech. And then the Mythbusters were there, Tim Lee, Brian Mallow, Norm Goldblatt, the other science comedians that appeared with me were there. I was talking about everything from macromolecules to chemical engineering. But this I have to say, that typically in the spring, this is only their second year. It is free to the public, usascientifestival.org. I personally recommend it very highly. If you were thinking of making a trip to D.C., do it over that weekend. Bring your kids to this, and I have never seen so many non-scientists and engineers enthusiastic about science and technology.
It was a big deal this weekend. I follow a couple space exploration feeds, both SpaceX and Virgin Galactic and that type of stuff. And they all were there, all represented, and they were really
You could meet astronauts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it was everything from there were guys talking before and after me on the physics of comic books and superheroes to the physics of movies. And it was just really interesting. And I will say this, the most compelling thing I saw, and I'm a huge fan of, what are the two meteorite crashing into the Earth movies?
Deep Impact. And Armageddon.
And the one where they sent Bruce Willis and the drillers up on the thing, which one was that?
That was Armageddon.
Okay. And they're both a little bit different, but I just like the whole movie genre. I think it's really neat. He debunks something very, very well.
And factually, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. It's
absolutely.
So much.
And that's okay. This guy said, okay, they said it was the size of Texas. So he made a sphere approximately the size of Texas. And, you know, that'll be plus or minus 30% on how you assume what you assume about it. But you make this sphere, and then you draw a two-scale line of 800 feet into that. You can't even see it on the diagram. So people are saying, oh, if we explode it on the surface, nothing will happen. But if we explode it at 800 feet, 800 feet is the surface, right? Just like, a few miles is the surface of the Earth. And I will say this, that, I was trying to do my best by finding the funny things in life that would get people engaged. And one of the jokes I told for most of my talks was, you know, let's face it, I was selling the T-shirts I sell on the road out there. And one of them says, nerds kick ass in the elements of the periodic table. And I point out to people, I said, look, it's historically interesting as well, because it's 142 years in the making, right? It's 142 years since Dmitri Mendeleev wrote down the first periodic table to 2011 when we named Darmstadtium, the 110th element, whose symbol is DS. And that was when you could first write nerds, right? You couldn't, because there was no D. There was an S for sulfur, but, D had stuff on it. Huh. So we could write nerds. And I reminded the audience, which was filled with middle school and high school kids, that before that, really the only cool thing you could spell with the periodic table of elements that was worth putting on a T-shirt were swear words. and people are upset. I said, you may be upset, but think about it. I have an entire generation of middle school kids thinking about the periodic table. My work is done.
You see. What you see.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. The point is, it's in its second year. Larry Bach is doing an absolutely fabulous job, and he's working for free just because this is important to him. So if you do get a chance, and there were people from all over the country there, next year in the spring, that would certainly be, in my opinion, something worth
seeing. So this was in D.C.?
Yeah, this was in D.C.
And was it D.C. last year? So it's like D.C. every year?
Yeah, it was D.C. last year, and it was on the Mall in tents, which was maybe a little more open. It wasn't as crowded, but I think it was a little hot because you're in a vinyl tent and things like that. But, you just rarely see so many good free things. I guess I was amazed that the first time I went to D.C. to be on, I think it was a NASA panel, I had some time free in the afternoon, and I went to the Smithsonian. I went to the Air and Space Museum. I didn't know those were free. I mean, they ask you for a donation, but to be honest, of all the uses of our tax money, that's some of the better stuff. And Larry puts this all together, and it doesn't cost anyone a dime, right? It's all the sponsors.
And the big one, the big facility out at Dulles Airport where the shuttle just arrived. That's free,
so
too.
That's the new one where they put the big exhibits. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool, too. So if you do see the Smithsonian, don't just see the one in downtown D.C. as well. Okay, so, Chris, let's talk about electric vehicles. So, is it fair to describe you as an electric vehicle enthusiast?
Yeah, another good word is evangelist, EV.
Yeah, because you did write that in your bio. You said in 2009 you got the religion after driving a Tesla Roadster. Now, a Tesla Roadster, that is a transformative experience from what I'm told.
Yeah, that car, you get in that car. So the spec is 0 to 60 in 3.7 seconds. So you could practically see space and time warping behind you when you accelerate in that car.
So it's like the Star Wars effect. The stars.
Yeah, you just see the curvature of behind you.
Right.
It is really mind blowing to be in that car. It's a very small car.
Sporty kind of race car type.
And
thing.
It's actually built based on a Lotus frame, Lotus Elise, which is a tiny sports car. Lotus is famous for very stripped down, small cars, high performance cars. And so they basically partner with Lotus and use Lotus frame to build a car.
But just to put it in perspective, 0 to 60 in 3.1 seconds, I mean, what's
3.7. To be fair, 3.7.
But what is the typical Porsche, Ferrari, what do they do typically?
They're like six,
yeah, that's
five,
what I hear.
Four.
Five,
yeah, really high end is 4 seconds. Yeah. Your average, you know, Mustang, Camaro, maybe 6, 7, 8.
Right, right. So I remember hearing 4 and 5 for race cars.
Yeah.
So, okay. And so why does it do it in 3.7? Is it because it's battery powered and you don't have this big engine?
Well, the electric motors are fundamentally different from internal combustion engines. And one way is that they have full torque at zero RPM. Mm-hmm. An internal combustion engine with pistons and spark plugs and all this stuff, it has a torque curve, a power curve, mm-hmm. and it reaches, so if you look in like a magazine and it says the car is rated for 150 horsepower, that's its peak horsepower. Mm-hmm. At the top of the curve, when the engine is screaming at 6,000 RPM, whatever,
right.
That's
so
when
you're going fast. But the low-end torque is often what they refer to these things as.
Yeah, and low-end torque is what's often missing in gas cars, so mm-hmm. That's what people look for. You know, enthusiasts look for low-end torque. Well, electric motors are fundamentally different. They have full torque at zero RPM, so they don't even need to idle.
Mm-hmm.
A gas engine car has to idle at around 750 or 1,000 RPM, and then you have to use clutches and gears
and
all this stuff to deal with the fact that there's what's called there's a dead band in gas engines from 0 RPM to 1,000 RPM. If you've ever driven in a manual transmission car mm-hmm. and held it in fourth gear while you slow down mm-hmm. to like 20 miles an hour, 10 miles an hour, the car starts chugging on you because it like stutters.
Yeah.
That's
just
because that engine can't do it. It can only it has to have a minimum speed. Electric motors don't have that. So what happens is when you're at the line and ready to bolt, mm-hmm. like at a stoplight or something, you don't have to like race the engine and drop the clutch and any of the stuff you do in a gas car. You just punch it. And that motor is already engaged.
Yeah, and your acceleration is very good.
It's very powerful. Yeah.
So what you're saying is you're talking about the top-end version of me driving the School of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering golf cart around. I'm at the light on campus, and when I punch it, I can accelerate for the first 2 seconds faster than any car in front of me or behind me. And then, of course, they overtake me.
Yeah, I say I beat anybody across the intersection. I beat most people off to the next block, and then it starts to tail off.
Okay.
And of course, that is the trade-off. At high speeds, these cars, like my passing speed from 60 miles an hour to 80 miles an hour, not so great. I mean, it's okay. It's just like an average car, but the low end is just a blast.
Okay.
So that's what, you know, I was kind of interested in this back in the 90s. There was a wave of electric vehicles. One of the GM EV1s actually made a visit to Georgia Tech campus and was the first person in line to test drive that. And so I was kind of interested in it, but the market hadn't matured. And then in April 2009, I happened to be out in California. I'd been following the development of the Tesla, which, you know, was kind of this perennial car that appeared in car magazines. Never actually real. It just kind of was like, oh, here's this, you know, gee whiz technology. AC Propulsion is a company that Tesla basically licensed their technology. So they're coming out with an electric sports car. Well, by 2009, they had finally succeeded and they were starting to crank it out. They were still on very thin ice financially, but the car was getting out. And so I got to test drive one, and it was amazing. I get there, and I had scheduled the test drive, and I expect, you know, salesman's going to ride with me, and he has me sign a piece of paper and throws me the keys and says, see you in an hour.
Cool.
It is hard to describe. You know, the things you experience when you drive a powerful car is noise, you know, this roaring engine.
Right.
As you shift from first to second to third, you have this kind of jerk in the car where you go.
And
electric cars don't have any of that. It's just pure. It's the hand of God behind you, just
pure
shoving
power.
You all the way to whatever speed you dialed
in. Yeah, you're very religious about your enthusiasm. That's good. That's an okay metaphor.
It's very exciting.
I mean, maybe we've busted myth number one, that people think electric cars are for little old ladies, and it's not this sexy American muscle machine. But what you're saying is when it comes to accelerating off the line, low-end torque, they are.
Yeah,
cool.
I love being at a stoplight next to, you know, a Mustang or something because they have no idea what. And I can't rev my engine or anything.
Right, right.
And the car is just, you know, kind of average looking. It's a little.
And do they ever look over at you like, hey, I'm going to take you? And
no. I look over at them and they're just like ignoring me and then they're in my rearview mirror.
Wow, that must be nice. All right, so I'm going to call that myth number one.
Yeah.
But let's do this. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's start talking about electric vehicles the additional myths associated with this in terms of efficiency and things like that, and then see where we go down the road. So we're talking with Chris Campbell about the great American love affair with what we hope one day will be electric vehicles here on Inside the Black Box. Science only funnier.
The following is a public service announcement brought to you by the staff of WREK Atlanta. Have you been tested for HIV? Local establishments in your area offer services to the community like AID Atlanta. AID Atlanta started as a grassroots organization in 1982 as an answer to the impact HIV was having on the Atlanta community. Today it offers comprehensive services from education to treatment. For more information, visit aidatlanta.org.
Shenandoah, I hear you calling.
It's a cold Sunday night.
Pull your feet up to the fire. Grab a warm cup of cocoa. Light your good pipe. Cuddle with a loved one or a fuzzy puppy. Then tune your radio to 91.1 on the FM dial.
You'll hear country, bluegrass, folk, and American traditional that you won't hear anywhere else on the radio. New music, old music, even some new music that sounds like old music.
So if you're tired of hearing pop country, another mainstream hogwash, tune into the Back Alley Pork Roost each and every Sunday night from 9 to 10 p.m.
That's the Back Alley Pork Roost, Sunday nights, 9 to 10 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta.
She's a mighty river.
Dearest listeners, each and every Sunday night from 9 to 10 p.m., experience the traditional music of America in its purest form.
From the most recent country bluegrass to the earliest forms of folk and traditional, hear a refreshing mix you won't hear anywhere else on the radio.
Back Alley Pork Roost, WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Chris Campbell, polymath engineer and electric vehicle enthusiast. So what about the history of electric vehicles?
So electric cars have been around for over 100 years. In fact, they basically precede internal combustion engines. So you had very simple cars in the late 1800s that had batteries and motors, and they're electric cars. But gas cars came along, and fundamentally, a battery is an energy storage device, as is a gas tank. And a gasoline, once they got the refinement and distribution worked out, gasoline is far more efficient at storing energy. I mean, at least 10 times.
Yeah, the energy density in your tank, very, very high. Yeah.
And that also means that refueling it is basically now a trivial process.
Being a liquid, that's very convenient.
So originally, and this kind of plays into your whole EVs are for or grannies concept. Originally, electric cars, 100 years ago, were marketed to women because the original gas cars needed a crank start. And you had to get out in front and crank this engine going. And eventually they came up with starter motors and you just turn a key.
Yeah, and for any of you guys thinking, well, of course, the little old ladies couldn't do that. Trust me, these crank starters were the kind of thing that if you moved the wrong way, it would break your arm.
Yep.
So this was
kick back on you.
I don't think I could start these cars today.
So they marketed towards women, but eventually they came up with starter motors and you just turn a key. And so that was pretty much the death knell for electric cars. So fast forward. And there's been DIY conversion activity ever since. There's a club in town called the EV Club of the South, and you can Google that and find their website. And those are mostly conversion guys that have taken old cars with blown engines and taken out the engine, put in a motor and battery. And you can do that with any car.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward to the 90s, California says, you know what, we need to try to clean up our air. They came out with the people of California, through the government, mandated zero emissions vehicles. And what they told the manufacturers, they put out a mandate saying, if you want to sell, if you, Toyota, GM, or anybody, if you want to sell any cars in California, you need to at least offer some zero-emission vehicles, some electric
cars.
As
an option for people to buy.
Right. You have to put it on the market. So, 96, 97, Toyota comes out with a RAV4 EV, so an electric SUV. GM comes out with the EV1. Honda has an offering. Ford has a pickup truck. They're all coming out with something. They are losing their shirt on it. The car companies were not making money on it. It's still very expensive technology. And they were pricing it expensive. I mean, these were, you know, $600, $700 a month leases.
Yeah, that's pricey.
But that was one thing that was very shrewd is the car companies only offered them as a lease. And you couldn't buy it at the end of the lease. So it was really still in the car company's hands or the bank's hands. And this is critical because this is where you get into kind of some, policy and conspiracy theories and all that stuff. And there's a movie about this called Who Killed the Electric Car? It was, why did the electric cars go away? The car companies knew that they would be able to get that mandate changed. And it's one of those funny things, if you look at the history of it, 2000, 2001, they literally redefined the term zero in the code. In the California code, you have zero emissions vehicles.
This often occurs with laws, right?
So now you have,
are good at that.
How did they
redefine it?
They redefine zero. They have something called partial zero.
Okay.
PZEV, P-Z-E-V. So you see this on emblazoned on cars in California, PZEV cars. You have advanced technology, PZEV, ATPZEV, all these acronyms. But fundamentally, the car companies were able to get zero emission vehicles redefined to be a little bit of emissions is okay.
Okay.
So very efficient, 40 miles per gallon, that's good enough.
Well, 40 miles a gallon is a good compact combustion. I drive one of those cars.
Yeah. That is, and you, if you look at it, if you compare it to, SUVs or even a 20 mile per gallon car, it's very good, very efficient car.
Okay.
It's not zero, but they got that immediately the day after they got that legislation passed. They stopped offering electric cars, and within 3 years, all the leases had expired and all the cars were pulled back.
Right.
And they crushed them. They sent them to the desert and ran them through crushers.
Okay.
And they were piled up.
But we're not surprised by this, are we, right? I mean, they're a company. And as much as people want to say, companies do good things, no, a company's job is to make money, for their shareholders.
Yep.
So it's in their own best interest to do this. And that's why we have government regulations for these sorts of things. So that doesn't surprise me.
So, why are we talking about this now? So what was happening in the 90s is they were making these cars, but the batteries weren't that great. They're very expensive to make. They were spending, they don't release what they were costing, but it was probably in the six digits. So $100,000 per car, and they weren't recouping that cost. What's happened in the last 15 years or so is that there's been massive improvements in battery technology. And we all have evidence of this on our belt or in our pocket, which mobile devices. Everybody's carrying a cell phone, probably a smartphone, or a BlackBerry, or a laptop, or an iPad.
Yeah.
All these things are powerful devices, power hungry, and need really good batteries. And so there's been this huge worldwide demand for very good batteries. And so that has driven this improvement in battery technology. So along comes Tesla. Tesla is a company now operated by, owned primarily by Elon Musk, who is this, technology rock star. And he came along and said, I'm going to take these exact same batteries that are being used for laptops, literally the same cell that are coming out by the millions out of production plants in Asia, and I'm going to stuff a sports car full of them and use that.
Simply just reproduced the cells. So like when you buy your laptop, you can buy the 3-cell battery, the 6-cell battery, depending on what capacity you want.
Exactly. Right. What's inside those is what's called a 18650 cell. It looks like a AA. It's a little bit bigger than a AA. And so the Tesla Roadster, which is this car we were talking about is with the obscene performance, has 6,000 of those little cells in a 700-pound pack behind the seat.
Right.
So it's the size of a really big suitcase. Anchoring the center of the car. Now, when he did that, the industry was like, he's going to lose his shirt because the battery is going to die after 3 years. And they didn't. And that's when everybody started taking notice that these cars were not just dropping dead after 3 years. The same way your cell phone battery lasts about 3 years. And
yeah,
then it just kind of dies.
I feel okay if it lasts 3 years. Because let's face it, right now, you upgrade your cell phone every 2 years and you don't even think about the battery.
Because the new shiny things come along. Yeah, so the fact that the battery is dying is just outside the window where you care.
Right.
So,
but everyone likes to keep a car more than 2 years.
Yeah.
So why were they lasting more than 3 years when the same cell in a cell phone battery or a laptop was not?
And so what Tesla did was they recognized the importance of what's called a TMS, thermal management system.
Okay.
They recognized that one of the things that really kills these batteries, and we're talking about lithium-ion batteries, they've just completely taken over the market, is temperature.
Mm-hmm.
High temperature kills the long-term life of a lithium-ion battery.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, just being out in hot weather or in your pocket, you know, you're getting up to 80 degrees, 90 degrees, that, if the battery works fine, it's delivering the power, but it's going to die within a few years. It's cooking the chemistry, and you're going to, you know, more, a lot more.
And in fact, this is a general thing, whether it's a battery, a fuel cell, or a microchip, all of them have curves for optimum temperature stability. We're now using GPUs to do a lot of calculations we use, and we look at the curves there, and literally just an extra 20 degrees on average over thousands and thousands of hours that we crank these things can drop you by a factor of 50%. And there are some fuel cells that work optimum at really high temperatures, some that work optimum at really low temperatures. But the problem is when it's in a car, and it's in California or Alaska in the winter, mm-hmm. you're never in the same thing unless you have an intelligent means to manage the temperature, which is what
you're
talking about.
So there's literally heating and cooling loops in the Tesla Roadster battery and some other electric cars we'll talk about. So they have literally a separate refrigerant loop, heating elements that are circulating inside that battery pack. So when it gets up to high temperature, it's cooling it down. It's actually using its own energy because the only energy source in that car is that battery. So it's sucking power out of the battery to help the battery. So it is cannibalizing the power, but it's a little bit to help the short-term performance and the long-term life. I talked about the high end of the temperature range. At the low end, it's not so much hurting the long-term life, it's short-term performance.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas you might get in the case of the Tesla Roadster, they quote, I think, 240 miles of range on their battery. If it's really cold weather, you might get 200 or 150.
Mm-hmm.
The cold weather really does knock down the range, and I've seen that with my car. I'll talk about that a little bit later.
Okay.
In that case, they use the TMS thermal management system to heat up the battery so you can get better power out of it. Cannibalize the power, but it improves the performance.
So a good example for those of you that I was talking to this weekend in Washington of what engineers do, the basic electrochemistry of a battery, that's been known for a long time. And then we find different anodes and cathodes like lithium ion. I said, but how you put it into practice and these efficiencies and where it behaves best, this is the engineering
and
part.
And cost.
Yeah.
Cost. You know, I mean, you can have a gold-plated battery that does everything, but it's not, you can't sell it because it costs $300,000.
Absolutely.
So,
I did not know that. That's amazing.
So that was Tesla's revolution. This is happening in around 2005, was they're going to go with this off-the-shelf battery that shouldn't last long because it's designed to last on laptops for 3 years. And they added this thermal management system around it to make it work better. There's another thing that they do to extend the life is lithium. We all remember NiCads, nickel cadmium batteries, the original rechargeable battery that we all had in cordless drills and stuff, or, you know, electric razor or whatever. And everybody of a certain age remembers that you had to occasionally remember to fully charge and fully discharge that thing,
or you get
because you'd have to remind the battery that it was capable of doing that. If you're just doing these little short discharges day after day, it would kind of forget that it had all this other capacity.
Yeah.
And so you've developed memory effect. And so the way to clear out the memory effect was to exercise the whole battery, charge all the way, discharge all the way. That was nickel cadmium. Lithium ion is fundamentally different chemistry, and it's actually the opposite. It does not like to be fully charged or fully discharged. It likes to live in the middle.
Oh, okay.
And so what Tesla did, and the Volt in particular, the Chevy Volt is doing on a greater scale, is they protect the extremes of that charging cycle. There's something called state of charge, SOC. In the battery world, SOC of 100% is fully charged, 0% is fully discharged. They don't ever let it get close.
Oh, okay.
Well, the volt doesn't even let it get close.
Right.
The,
and how do they do that? Some hand comes out of the hood and smacks and says, you better charge this thing?
Or, yeah,
I'm sure it's more elegant than that.
There's a charge controller that just stops pulling power. So in the case of the Roadster, I believe it's like a 5% to 95% swing. Okay. So they're protecting that last 5%. Mm-hmm. Because if you go all the way to that 100% or 0%, the car, it'll survive, but not won't survive 10 years.
Okay.
You're abusing the chemistry, basically, and
so
it'll
die. So that's
good
to know, because I just assumed that the lithium ion memory effect was less than NiCad's, and I'm an extreme guy. I'm an extreme guy with my combustion vehicle, right? I'll be like, I'm driving on fumes. I better go fill this thing up. But what I do like to do is I do like to actually plug it in and keep it, you know, in the middle charge. I don't want to do all the way discharge and things like that. What you're saying is that's not bad because it's lithium ion.
And what all the car makers are saying is do whatever you want. If you want to leave it plugged in every day when you don't really need to, that's fine. If you want to leave it at 50% or 40% and half charge, that's fine too. Everything's fine. They basically are taking care of that in the controller where they aren't letting you go fully charged or fully discharged.
Okay, great.
So that was there's one more thing to talk about in battery technology. There's three things that they did. Third thing is the chemistry. We've been talking about lithium ion batteries.
Mm-hmm.
Lithium ion is a class of battery.
Mm-hmm.
The lithium ion is the goop, is the electrolyte that's in the battery.
Right.
And the electrodes, the cathode and the anode, are made of some kind of material, you know, it's graphite or whatever. And what that material is defines how the battery behaves. In particular, things like thermal stability, long-term life, thermal runaway, which was a big deal. Everybody remembers the first lithium-ion batteries that were, there was this, unfortunately, Sony got branded with this problem.
Yeah, and you can
Sony
see
laptops caught on fire. There's a burst of white flame coming out of the laptop. These were the earliest lithium-ion batteries, which were really sexy. Everybody wanted them because they were so power dense. You could get 6 hours of life out of battery. But it was a chemistry that wasn't quite mature and it wasn't stable.
Right.
And so thermal runaway is an engineer's way of saying fire, explosion,
yes, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. But it sounds more elegant.
So that has evolved. And so now the most conservative battery chemistry that's being used in cars has manganese electrodes, and that's of course not pure manganese. It's basically iron doped with iron carbon doped with manganese. Another one you'll hear is iron phosphate. So it's lithium iron phosphate, and that spells out with your elements as LIFEPO, LIFEPO, for LIFEPO. So you hear hardcore EV guys, especially conversion guys, they're putting LIFEPO kits in their car.
Right.
Those are kind of cutting edge right now, and the car manufacturers are still a little leery of them, so they're using what I call, you know, the manganese cells.
Right.
So you did three things to get away from having a 3-year life on a battery to now 10 to 15 years of life. Thermal management system.
Mm-hmm.
Protect the extremes of charge, so don't charge it all away, don't discharge it all away. So you're basically giving up the ends of that capability. And then... And I've forgotten the chemistry of
the electrodes, right? Not the electrolyte, the thing that allows the ions to go back and forth. And really what you're describing is, and when people think about this, well, what are we doing with batteries? What are we doing with fuel cells? You're absolutely right. The old alkaline or acid batteries, that's what they use, alkaline or acid. And they can change that electrolyte a little. They can change the lithium ion electrolyte as well. And we have lots of electrolytes. We have solid electrolytes. Same thing with the fuel cells. But an unbelievable amount of research goes into taking what used to be a single metal and now makes it a metal oxide with another metal mixed in there, and it's mixed in there in a amorphous, mesomorphic, honeycomb shape, all this sort of stuff to prevent corrosion, oxidation, reduction. Some of the metals just diffuse away. I mean, there's tremendous amount of materials chemistry going on the surfaces of either electrodes or in a fuel cell, the catalysts, to make these things behave the way they do. And we are learning tons and tons every single day and applying that. And whatever you're thinking is the state-of-the-art one used in commercial stuff, there's 20 levels of crazy people doing interesting things on that.
Not a week goes by that you don't have some a big press release. Last week was a big deal. IBM announced a major effort in lithium air mm-hmm. which is it involves, you know, air flowing through the battery.
Right.
They've got partnerships. There's lots of companies working very hard on this. And certainly there's lots of venture capital. There's Washington, D.C., right. Washington Wall Street interest in it.
And there's plenty of government funds going to fund academic institutions that do these very things. We're more at the fundamental cutting edge,
mm-hmm.
but this research takes money, and sometimes at the cutting edge, you need to kickstart it with something. And then once people look at it and say, I think in 30 years I can make money out of that, boom, they'll take it. And you'll have 1,000 candidates, and maybe three will end up being something mm-hmm. that you can use.
Yep.
But lots of research going in on this.
Yep.
So let's do this. Let's take a quick break. And we come back, let's maybe dovetail from battery technology and what these changes have done for efficiency and, you know, lifetime of the battery into efficiency and maybe some of the myths that we've talked about before the program
yep.
With regard to electric vehicles. So,
and we'll use a scary word called thermodynamics.
You know,
no, maybe we won't. Sorry.
No, we will.
Please come back.
On this show, we can use that scary word, thermodynamics. We'll be right back with more electric vehicles here on Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
You know who you are. You know you have a problem. How it's all slipping away under your feet like quicksand into an agonizing vortex of lies and pain and stupidity. You know. Life sucks, and we understand. We're the Church of the Subgenius, and we're here with proven therapies that can help you survive your daily hell march by giving you the ability to laugh in the face of the horror. Indeed, to laugh your guts out. The Hour of Slack and Bob's Slack Time Funhouse deliver a solid 2-hour dose of psychic medication to armor you against the deadly friction of your everyday existence. That's Midnight Saturdays on WREK Atlanta. The Hour of Slack and Bob's Slack Time Funhouse from the Church of the Subgenius. We don't know exactly what we are, but we know for sure that we're not them.
From 1961 through 2011, we offer you 50 years of surf and instrumental rock on the Longboard Show, Tuesdays at 9 p.m. on WREK Atlanta.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Chris Campbell about the great American love affair that we anticipate will happen with electric vehicles. And if you've got a question or comment about this fascinating topic, and you're listening to us live Wednesdays, noon to 1, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. So we talked about the three advances in battery technology.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we want to talk about next?
Let's talk about efficiency. Because I would say the number two myth, the first one was that these are anemic cars. They can be very exciting
and
cars.
And we've dispelled that with your experience at the at the stop sign with Tesla Roadster.
As has a Roadster, even the affordable cars that you get now, Nissan Leaf, Chevy Volt.
Okay.
Those are exciting cars at the low-end speed range for sure.
So in these little sedans, you can blow away much heavier muscle cars at the line.
Yeah, it's a stealth car. It's really great.
Sweet. Okay. So efficiencies.
So the myth is the myth of the long tailpipe, which is, you know, a lot of critics will say, or somebody coming to this, and they see some of these cars will have a big graphics on the side, and it says zero emissions. Nissan Leaf in particular is big on marketing the car as zero emissions. No emissions out of the tailpipe. And somebody will say, well, you're just moving the point of emissions to the power plant. You're mm-hmm. using fossil fuels, probably, to generate the power, transmitting the energy to the car, but the pollution's still coming out of the power plant.
Right.
There's all sorts of efficiencies involved in here, but fundamentally, an electric powertrain in your car and the power plant with its ability to convert fossil fuel to electricity, both of those are far more efficient in particular a power plant, is way more efficient at extracting energy out of that fossil fuel than your little portable gas engine in your car.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It,
the power plant is not constrained by weight. You can have, you know, it can weigh 1,000 tons of metal for the furnace or whatever it is. And it's not as constrained by cost as your car engine. Your car engine has to cost a couple $1,000s so they can, you know, sell at a reasonable price. So there's power plants are much more efficient. And so there's something called a well-to-wheels analysis that's been done over and over for the last 10 years. There's an organization called Plug In America. You can just Google that, pluginamerica.org, that has done kind of a meta survey of all of these analyses.
Right, so they've looked at all the analyses.
Right, analysis of analyses.
Of the surveys.
Right.
Yeah,
so. And so the well, if you do a well-to-wheels analysis, what that is you're starting with extracting the fossil fuel out of the ground, and then finally, at the very end, you're moving the car.
Right.
The wheels are turning.
Right. So the same basis. We go from the fossil fuel to the car, regardless of what the path in between is.
So the gasoline path is you take it out, you send it to a refinery, you send it to the gas station, you put it in the car. Yeah. And there's all sorts of energy consumed
in
that process.
Tank, you've got to drive it. Right.
Well, then there's the refinery. There's the running the tanker across the ocean. There's the actually extracting it out of the ground. And then the electrical process is you're still getting the fuel in some different form, maybe not as refined as gasoline, but you're getting some sort of fuel, coal or whatever, to the power plant, generating electricity, and then transmitting electricity through the grid, goes into your battery and comes back out of your battery. You got some efficiency there, goes to the motor. If you do those two different paths, an electric car is still more efficient than almost any gasoline car, even assuming a dirty coal power plant.
Right.
And that's what we have down in the south here. We have a lot of dirty coal in the northeast, a lot of dirty coal. You kind of get into a little bit of shaving the issue of, are you talking about carbon dioxide emissions or particulate or sulfur? And and so at the fringes, you can argue that, but there's almost no overlap. The electric vehicles are way more efficient than gasoline.
And regardless of what people think, we think of as a nice liquid gasoline being burned as very efficient combustion. In even new cars, it's not 100% complete combustion. And in older cars, it's definitely not because they burn a little oil along with it. And I used to live in Los Angeles where we started our conversation. And trust me, that's not just CO and CO2 out there. There are particulates and a lot of that comes from
NOxes and sulfur.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where we get to the thermodynamics, which is that a power plant might have a thermodynamic efficiency of maybe 33%. Actually taking the theoretical amount of energy that's in that gasoline and actually getting extracting energy, useful energy out of it. A gas car might have 18-20%. And that's at the higher end. You know, you're talking about a Prius, what's called an Atkinson cycle engine. They have the higher end, 18-20%, but that's still a good one-third lower than what a power plant is capable of.
Right.
And then the rest of that's just the hard part for the electrical process. Everything else is all in the 90s, 95% transmission grid, 98% battery, 95% electric motor. You have all these 90s that stack up.
Right.
So really it's the fact that the power plant is much more efficient at converting to electricity.
Okay. So let me ask you a question. What about range? You mentioned the Tesla range was about 250 miles.
Yeah.
Which is pretty practical. I can live with
that. That's the long pole in the tent in the market. Most pure electric cars that are on the market now, you have a Nissan Leaf, which is been out for a year and a half now. You have Ford Focus, which is coming out right about now.
So the Focus is doing an electric version.
Yep, there's a Ford Focus electric. Actually, it was the pace car at a NASCAR race this weekend, which is pretty funny. Typically, what they're shooting for is 100 miles of range.
Okay.
Now, you know, everybody says, well, I want to have more range. But the problem is it's a trade-off. It's a trade-off on weight and cost. Yeah. You can get 240 miles of range. A Tesla Roadster costs $130,000.
Right.
Nobody's going to buy that car.
It's a sports car for rich serial entrepreneurs who are like, hey, let's get this thing.
Right.
I'm not going to buy that car. Let's put it that way.
So the market seems to be settling around 100 miles range as a good sweet spot for 100 miles will get you all over town.
That'll handle
in one
my
day.
Commute plus all the errands and a little extra.
One of my friends had a good story of so he flies his own plane and he lands at, I think it's the Fulton County Airport. And he's talking about he landed one time and he saw there was a G5 there and the CEO of GE got off and he got in his Chevy Volt, or not Chevy Volt, he got in his Tesla and drove off. And he's like, I'm not,
and
not
it wasn't a Chevy Bolt. Yeah.
No, it was a.
Okay.
Was it whichever? Is it GE that owns Tesla or is it whatever else?
But Tesla's independent.
Does own okay, Chevy.
But you think about GM.
Okay, so I'm thinking about, yeah.
GM?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the CEO of GM, and he got in his Chevy Volt and drove off.
Oh,
and
well,
my friend
nice.
Was saying that he didn't think that would, you know, off-put the emissions of his G5.
Yeah, that's right, because we learned when they testified on Capitol Hill, they do not fly commercial.
Right.
So these are, so 100 miles is the typical range that you're seeing in pure electric cars. But, and this is where we get into, so that's got a pure electric car. The Volt is different, significantly different, and it's kind of confusing.
Yeah,
because
it's got both.
It's got
and
both.
And even the commercial's confusing.
It's a complicated car, and unfortunately, there's things like people are calling it, it's just a hybrid. Well, it's not just a hybrid. Mm-hmm. So the fundamental thing about a Chevy Volt is that it is a pure electric car for the first 35 miles. The first 35 miles every day is pure electric. After 35 miles, the battery, the big battery in the car has depleted, and a gas engine kicks in to go further. But the key is, for that first 35 miles, it's pure electric, and it's full performance. It can go 100 miles an hour. It can go embarrass Mustangs. You can do all that stuff. First 35 miles is pure electric. If you're driving, if your daily drive is 35 miles or less, you will go your average day back and forth every day pure electric, and you never actually end up burning gas for your average day.
Right.
What it gives you is the capability to go longer distances, like a road trip. You can go. I drove 1,000 miles in my Volt when I actually bought it out of town and drove it back to Atlanta.
Right.
1,000 miles, no problem. It's just like a regular car in that case. But most people's driving is regular short daily trips, 35 miles or less.
The horrible efficiency driving that we do is the commute. The road trip on the highway at high speed, that's the much more efficient sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it, like a hybrid, does it charge the battery from the engine?
No. In the case of the Volt, what they do... Okay, so let's talk about hybrid versus Volt.
So that's why it's not a hybrid, I'm guessing.
Well, I have this this graphic, which I will put up to the microphone and everybody can see it. But basically, a hybrid is a gas car with electric assist. It's a gas engine with a little bit of little electric motor. So when you're going from zero to like 10 miles an hour or slowing back down, it's just using that electric motor just to, if you're in stop and go traffic, the hybrid's kind of
that's
the
good.
Electric
motor. Gas motor with electric assist.
A Chevy Volt.
Well, I was saying, if you've ever been in a Prius, it actually has on the dash when it's using gas and when it's using electric, so you can see those things.
So a Chevy Volt is fundamentally an electric car not with gas engine assist, but rather with gas engine for range extension.
Yeah.
So it doesn't need the gas engine to do anything for the first 35 miles. And that is the fundamental difference. The fundamental difference between a Prius and a Volt is when I plant my right foot down in a Prius, that gas engine is going to start. And it's going to move the car. In a Volt, it doesn't. For that first 35 miles of the day, it's a pure electric car. And for me, it's turning out to be like 98% of my day time.
Yeah, that's most of my stuff is my commute. Right. Absolutely.
So these electric cars are a lot of fun, but they're also extremely efficient, and that's because it's in the case of Volt, it's a pure electric car and has the gas engine to go longer distances.
Now, the Nissan Leaf, that is a pure electric car.
It's a pure electric car.
Okay.
So that's 100-mile range. And so that is not able to do long road trips, but it's certainly great as a city car. And so you're seeing it used either people will use it as a second car for the household.
Yes,
so they'll have another car that they can go on road trips on, but the Leaf is what they used to drive around
town. So if you have one car, you're going to buy a Chevy Volt.
Yep.
If you've got two cars, so my wife, we have two kids, we have two cars. We need two cars. I got a teenager that drives, right? Mm-hmm. We can't live without two cars. I would, and you know, I drive a internal combustion engine car that gets really good gas mileage. It's really small. That's my commute car. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about getting an electric vehicle to do just that. Yep. And it's like, you know, I probably go 25 miles in and 25 miles back. So 100 miles would be great. We would use that most of the time around town. Mm-hmm. But the one trip to my niece's wedding in Houston, we'll take the minivan, which is gas and things like that.
Yep. So let's. One thing we should talk about is charging and you know, public charging and how do the cars charge. One of the experiences from the 90s was that they didn't figure out a standard for charging, and all the different cars that they had in the 90s had different ways to plug in. So now there's a standard, and so if you go to any electric car now that you buy since 2010, it has the exact same interface. And what they standardized, the Society of Automotive Engineers, SAE, standardized what they call levels. Level 1, level 2, level 3 charging.
Mm-hmm.
Level 1 is a cord that typically comes with a car and plugs into a regular outlet.
Mm-hmm.
Regular outlet, I had one on my deck on the side of my house, and that's how when I first got the car, I plug it in. Mm-hmm. And for my car, for a Chevy Volt, which has the 35 miles of range, so 35 miles pure electric range, it takes about 10 hours. Mm-hmm. So basically it's an overnight activity. With the 110 mm-hmm. volt regular outlet, I plug it in when I get home. Next morning it's ready to go. So the first 35 miles is free, the next day, and then every day it's charged up, ready to go. If that's not fast enough for you, okay, so that was the Chevy Volt. The Nissan Leaf, the Ford Focus, these pure electric cars that have 100 miles of range and a bigger battery, they take longer to charge.
Mm-hmm.
And with that 110 volt plugging into a wall, you're looking at more like 22 hours.
Right.
Which isn't realistic if you have, you're trying to use it every day. I mean, you're spending almost the whole 24 hours charging the car.
Yeah.
So that's when you get to the next level, which is level 2. And that's a 240 volt connection, maybe a higher current depending on the car's capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a wall mount kind of charger. And it takes the type of circuit that you would have for your electric clothes dryer.
Right. But 240 volt. An electrician could put that 240 volt plug in your garage for a fee and it wouldn't be that bad.
Yep. Yeah. And so I got one of those. And so that charges the Volt in about 3.5 hours, the Leaf in about 8 hours. So now we're back to overnight.
Overnight.
You know, for a pure electric car that has 100 mile range. And then the third one is still being argued, and there's kind of a VHS or beta argument going on in the industry right now about what standard to use. But that is something called, they want to call it level 3. It's not standardized yet, but it's DC fast charging.
Okay.
Because what it does, when I charge with a regular plug, a wall outlet, it's AC going to the car, but battery chemistry is DC. So somewhere in the car, it has to convert from AC to DC.
As there are a lot of our appliances, and there are people that would like to convert the local delivery of power purely to DC to eliminate all these bulky transformers that hang out.
And Edison would be like, I finally won.
Yeah, and Tesla would have lost. Okay. All right, we could do a whole other show on that.
So AC-DC conversion in the car, but that's a bottleneck.
Yeah.
And so this level 3 is where they're bypassing that bottleneck, and you're sending you have a DC charger, which is a very expensive box and lots of power, and it's a fire hose electricity goes in the car, and that can charge most of the battery in 30 minutes.
Okay. Well,
so now you're talking about more like a gas station experience where you pull into a gas station, get a cup of coffee, read a newspaper, and your car's charged up again.
Okay. And that's kind of the standard they use, because when we talked about hydrogen and we talked about density, right? Hydrogen's a gas, not very dense. So the only way it'll work is if you make it as an absorbed hydride, which is almost like a liquid. And their view was, look, if you can do a coffee break and read the paper, people can tolerate that. Anything more than that, it's not going to work.
Yep.
So, and this should not be unusual to people, because when you charge your cell phone, if I'm putting it directly in for fast charge in the wall, as opposed to coming off the USB port in my computer and things like that, I've got different rates as well.
Yeah.
So
GM, when they looked at this market, their fundamental decision was, we can't get around this charging speed issue. So they just came up with small battery, you're going to charge it overnight, and for longer trips, the gas engine kicks in, and you're still capable to do it.
Right, but if you commute 35 miles a day, boom, that's a huge lack of emissions and efficiency in terms of the electric use. Mm-hmm. Here's my question, though. What about the cost? The cost per mile from electricity versus gas, I've always read, is much cheaper.
Yeah. So I don't go to gas stations anymore because most of my driving around town is gas-free, pure electric. And really, the only time I ever buy gas is when I'm on a road trip.
Right.
So driving, I drove to West Virginia last summer. Mm-hmm. So I don't go to gas stations anymore. The flip side of that is my electric bill has gone up $10 a month.
Whereas I pay $10 for 2.5 gallons of gas.
And that's a very efficient car.
Wow.
My car outperforms your car. So if you do a really more apples-to-apples comparison where you're comparing to a more powerful car, like 25-mile-per-gallon car, 20-mile-per-gallon car, you're saving a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. Mine's 40-mile-per-gallon car, so it's, wow.
So my operating costs, I have tire rotation and I have to replace the tires. We haven't even talked about regen braking, but basically I'm not using the brake pads that much. So what's happened with these electric cars is you're taking a car that you buy for a certain amount and then you have operating costs. You're front-loading the cost. You're paying more for the car up front,
right?
And then it costs almost nothing to operate over the life of the car.
And the life of the car is typically
The battery is the weak spot, and they say they warranty it for 8. And most of these cars, they're warranting for 8 years.
Okay.
They said that they've targeted 10 to 15 years of life on the battery.
Can you replace the battery?
You can. And the next question, we don't know. Often people ask, okay, well, what's it going to cost to replace the battery? 8 years from now?
Yeah, that cost
we don't
is
know.
What
that cost is coming down fast.
Ooh, so that's good.
There was a quick question from a caller. Yeah.
Okay.
And saying, I didn't quite understand this. What
No. That's.
Oh, we got
I think that they got that answered.
Oh, okay.
Anyway,
okay.
There's another question. It's so you said the first 35 miles are free?
I like to say the first 35 miles are fun and free.
Okay, so his question was, if you're sitting in a traffic jam in 90-degree heat with like the AC on, like how does that get affected?
It is using up some energy out of the battery to run air conditioning and do that kind of stuff. It's not a whole lot. I mean, we're talking like 10% of the energy of the car. When you're driving a car, 90% of it is used to move the car down the road.
Right.
Air conditioning is, it is. I mean, I have had experience where we go to the drive-in. There's a drive-in on Moreland Avenue, the Starlight drive-in.
One of the few that it's
great drive-in. It's really a gem for Atlanta. We go to the drive-in. In 2 hours, I burn off maybe 6 miles of range, because that's how it's indicated to me on the dash, is miles of range. Just with the windows rolled up, the air conditioning running, but the car, you know, I'm not bothering
it. Idling.
I'm not idling, so I'm not bothering everybody, but the air conditioning's on. And so maybe 3 miles, but 3 miles of range.
So that's an interesting point, right? I mean, you can't leave your car running in a drive-in theater if it's a gas car.
That's right.
But you can.
I can.
You can have air-conditioned movie
and
comfort.
Actually, that number I gave you, 3 miles of range per hour of sitting there, is actually distorted because I have the windows down.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So at the window, and I've done this in parades. I did a parade in Dunwoody in last July. Really hot weather. Windows down. We have our hands out. We're waving, and air conditioning was cranked, and you know, I sucked down some range. But drive-in is great because it's perfectly quiet car.
Well, we've reached the point where we have to admit we haven't covered half of what we need to. So what we need to do is wait maybe in 6 months or a year for the next big development in electric cars and have you back to talk about that and all the other stuff we didn't necessarily talk about. But let me see if I can take a crack at summarizing what we've learned today. And it's a lot, right? Electric motors, very good at the low speed end. That's the high torque. Torque, by the way, we're not going to define, but it's the ability to twist that rotor and get these things going. 0 to 6 in 3.7 seconds, which is better than most any other muscle car can do. And what's really made this possible is 3 critical advances in battery technology. And the first one came from the folks at Tesla, which is managing the heat. Almost everything in the world has a different efficiency depending on what its temperature is. Batteries are no exception. And what Tesla did is they managed the heat to sort of hit that sweet spot. Another one was literally just the chemistry of these things by improving the chemistry of the electrodes. Mm-hmm. We've actually done a heck of a lot better. And by actually managing the state of charge, right?
Yep.
Lithium-ion batteries, for those of you like me that were under this misconception, so here's yet another one of our myths, is that the memory effect in batteries, right, isn't as bad in lithium-ion. And in fact, you like to live in the middle.
Stay away from the edges.
Right. So managing that gives you much better performance out of these whole things. The other great misnomer is, even if you think about this long tailpipe, right, go all the way back to the power plant and producing it, it's still more efficient.
Yep.
And no one would argue that a coal-fired power plant, if you've ever seen their smokestacks, doesn't produce a lot of pollution. But it doesn't produce the pollution right there where you live. Worse yet, in California, where everything's a valley that butts up against the mountains, and you can see the smog come in and just get contained there at, you know, the mountains at the edge of the LA
area. But even if you count the pollution that's being emitted someplace else, it's still a cleaner car.
It's still cleaner, even if you take into account that redistribution. And then probably the other big myth is these are cool cars, right? And, you know, you're driving your Volt or your Nissan Leaf, and you're thinking, well, it's not exactly what I'd call a chick magnet, you know, and I will risk offending women. Let's say guy magnets, too, right? What was the really big chick car, the convertible? I'm trying to think. Was it Toyota?
The Miata,
right. That's
exactly. I knew a guy had a Miata, so he would bristle
at that. I have a lot of guys who had Miata. I thought the Miata was a chick car, but women told me, no, it's not. It's what women actually drive. But in any case, so people may criticize it, but when you're at the stoplight and you take off and use that low-end torque and beat them to the punch, there you go.
Yep.
So did I leave anything out?
I just wanted to give people two web addresses.
Okay.
My website, which is really simple, it's just basically a list of references, is firstvoltingeorgia.com.
Which is linked to insidethablackbox.org, so you can find it on our website.
And there. And the other one is my favorite advocacy organization is called pluginamerica.org. Mm-hmm. If you go to pluginamerica.org/vehicles, you get a database of every car that's in development right now, and it's just pages and pages and pages. So all these companies are doing it. So GM and Nissan are obviously in the lead. Ford is coming out later this year. Tesla is, you know, the poster child. It's very, very sexy cars. Watch BMW. BMW is very slow but very deliberately marching their way towards really cornering a large segment of the market. They've had these test vehicles out, and they've just been evolving. And by a year or two from now, they're going to be on market. And they're important to watch.
And I'm sure within a year or so we'll have you back talking about those developments and all the things we didn't cover today. But Chris, thanks so much for being on the program.
Glad to be here.
And if you've got a question or comment for us or a suggestion for a future program, by all means send us an email at comments@insidethablackbox.org. Our theme music is performed and written by Bill and Mary Hunt. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman, and we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Bringing you music from around the world and your own backyard. This is WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.